So just so everybody who's listening online knows, we've agreed that we're going to make up the class time that we missed next Monday, which would be the 14th, I think? Yes. February 14th, right here at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we'll be talking, that'll be the first B101 lecture. Today we're finishing up the theory of contracts. So everybody who can be here Monday at 10, please do. But this will be available online by Tuesday so that you can follow along with it. Interpreting contracts. You might think it's a very easy kind of thing to do. You look at the contract and it says what it says. But you wouldn't believe how many disputes there are over the meaning and interpretation of contract terms. There are things that are left out of contracts, things that aren't very accurately described. There are things that are contradictory in contracts. In the construction field, there are a lot of them, because drawings and specifications are incorporated into construction contracts. If there's any kind of inconsistency or contradiction, that's something that has to be interpreted because it's not completely clear. Now, the one rule that's almost always true is that a court will not rewrite the contract for the parties. Even if it's unfair, even if the court doesn't like the implications, whatever the parties agreed to is what the court is going to try to enforce. The only real exception for this involves consumer contracts. Typically, you know, you open a package of software and it's got all these terms and conditions, or else you're on a computer screen and you have to click accept to accept a bunch of contract terms that you don't even bother to read through. In situations like that, a court might consider whether the terms are truly fair because there's no bargaining going on. It's accept or reject. But for the construction field, for architecture, where you have people who are negotiating with pretty much even bargaining power, the court is not going to rewrite any contracts. If you make a bad deal, if you don't charge enough fee for your work, the court's simply going to hold you to the fee that's in the contract and isn't going to rewrite it to give you a working wage. The purpose of the court in interpreting a contract is to figure out what the bargain was that the parties struck. Their goal is to figure out what the deal was and to enforce that. That's part of the meeting of the minds concept that is what a contract is all about. The parties' minds met on an agreement, and that's what the court is trying to figure out. Now, the first step, dealing with a written contract at least, in a court's analysis of interpreting a contract is to look at the written language of the contract. I mean, it's there in black and white. What does it say? If the language in question is clear and unambiguous, that is the end of the analysis. The court won't go beyond that. If the contract language is perfectly clear, then that is the interpretation and the court stops right there. You aren't allowed to explain it or clarify it or anything else like that. You might, you know, in a trial on the contract, be on the witness stand and trying to say, yes, it does say this, but what I really meant was the following. The court won't even allow that testimony to be made, because if the language is perfectly clear, that's the end of the analysis. That means that if you're drafting or signing or negotiating a contract, you need to read it carefully. If the language in black and white doesn't match up with what your expectations are about the deal, you've got to change it. Because if you sign it as is and it's different from your real deal, the court will enforce it as is, even if both of you knew that the deal was something else. Because that's the end of the analysis when the language is clear. But often, something that seems perfectly clear isn't. Let me give you a potential contract clause. It says, in exchange for the architectural services described above, the owner will pay the architect the sum of $10,000 no later than January 1, 2012. Boy, that sounds pretty clear and unambiguous, doesn't it? How many ways can you interpret it? There's a payment of $10,000 and it's due by the beginning of the year. open and shut, right? Well, lawyers exist to try to pick holes in things like this. One of our talents is to analyze something and find the ambiguity where nobody else does. So what if I were to change things a little bit and tell you that this project was in Windsor, Ontario, but the Canadian who owned the house hired a lawyer from across the river in Detroit. Not a lawyer, an architect from across the river in Detroit. Would that make the language any less clear? It would to me, because $10,000 now could be $10,000 U.S. or $10,000 Canadian, which is about worth $7,000 or so U.S., if I have the exchange rate right. Now, all of a sudden, you've introduced an ambiguity where it didn't seem as if one existed. So you've got to be careful about anticipating what the issues might be. You, as an architect, working out of Detroit, figure you've got a fee of $10,000 coming. Isn't it going to be odd when you receive a check for $10,000 Canadian drawn on a bank from Toronto or something like that, and that only translates to $7,000 your way? So it's not easy always to anticipate what these are going to be, but the idea is to be aware of the issues that affect your practice if you're entering into a contract. And if you're entering into a contract, spell it out exactly. It would have been very easy to say U.S., especially knowing that you had a Canadian client who might have been under a different impression about what kind of currency was being used. If you have ambiguity or contradiction or omission or something like that in the contract, then the court goes to a second level of analysis, and that's called parole evidence. Parole, which means outside. It doesn't have anything to do with being paroled from prison. That's spelled with an E, I think. But parole evidence is the willingness, is testimony or other documents or other information that somebody supplies to explain what the written word in the contract means. So with the Canadian client, you might have introduced your proposal, which isn't the contract itself, just a letter proposal you made when you were suggesting that the owner hire you, and it may have quoted a fee of $10,000 U.S. in the proposal, even though the U.S. didn't find its way into the contract. That would show the court that you, at least, had always intended the fee to be paid in U.S. dollars. Now, that's not decisive, because there are two parties to a contract, not just one. It's possible that the client, the owner, truly thought that this was supposed to be $10,000 of his or her own currency, and they would have the opportunity to explain why they believed that the dollar sign was for Canadian money. It might be that they get on the witness stand and they talk about how you agreed that the project is in Windsor, so as much as possible will be Canadian rather than American. And they intended that to include payment. Now, that may not be clear. I can't tell you how a court would resolve something like that. There are different rules that a court could apply that we will probably we'll get to in a little bit. But the idea is that parole evidence will be considered by a judge or an arbitrator when the contract is silent or ambiguous or in some way unclear. What are the terms of the contract that a court or an arbitrator would look at? Well, they fall into two different categories, express terms and implied terms. Express just means that they're really there. They were really communicated. So if it's a written contract, the express terms will be what's written on the face of the contract. If it's an oral contract, the express terms will be whatever the parties actually said to each other to create the contract. But the express terms are the ones that are actually present in the contract itself. Now, implied terms are part of the contract even though they were never explicitly communicated. And that's because often people make a deal without being thorough about the way they document the deal. So there will be implied terms in a contract. There are some that are almost always implied. For example, if A is in a contract with B, each party is promising not to do anything that makes it more difficult for, or unreasonably difficult, for the other party to perform. So if you're an owner who hires a contractor to build something, you can't sign a construction contract and then deny the contractor access to the site, because that's preventing the contractor from performing his work. If you're a contractor and you enter into a short-form construction contract to build something, there will be an implied term in the contract that says that your work, your construction work, will be done in a good and workmanlike manner. Not perfect, but in a typical quality for the industry. Good and workmanlike is typically what's used in that situation. For architects, every contract you have for architectural services contains a term that's either expressed or implied that your work will be done in accordance with the applicable standard of care for architects. That means with the levels of skill, care, and diligence that the average typical architect would employ in a similar situation. We're going to talk a lot later on in the class, not this period, but in future classes, about an architect's standard of care. But in any contract for professional services, this standard of care provision is implied. I mean, you go to the doctor, you expect him and he treats you. You don't have any kind of discussion of your contract, but an implied term in your deal is that the doctor will perform reasonably, not negligently, but with the appropriate levels of care. It's true for architects, it's true for lawyers as well. There may be other terms that are implied by the specific circumstances of the deal. So if you have a contract for architectural services that mentions that the goal is for construction to start in April, it's implied that you will have your construction documents done in time for the contractor to bid and enter into a contract for an April start. So it probably means something like a month earlier. At least that would probably be an implied term. Now, it could be a different term. It could be that there's much more leisure time in the project, or it's under a rush, or something like that, in which case timing could be implied in a different way. I don't want to tell you that it's always the same implied term, but the circumstances of the deal will imply terms into a contract that are necessary for the contract to make sense. Because most of the time, when you guys draft contracts, and even when I do, we don't think of every single important term that might be included. We leave some to be implied. Now, how are they implied? Remember the seventh hierarchy of laws? The lowest on the hierarchy is called custom and practice. Well, that is usually the source of many of the implied terms. What does custom and practice mean again? It means what's typically and usually done in the situation, in this case in the design or construction industries. So whatever is usual and normal for architects or for contractors will be implied into the contract, even if it's not spelled out. But of course the express terms govern the implied terms. If the contract explicitly says the construction documents are to be ready March 15th, then you don't imply a March 1 completion date just because you're hoping to start construction in April. The express terms clearly identify the party's agreement. The implied terms are only put there because the court infers that they're necessary in order to have a full agreement. So express terms always govern. Contradictions or inconsistencies in contracts occur way more often than you'd ever think. People can argue about the meaning of terms from here to eternity. There are specs that aren't totally consistent with drawings all of the time, and yet they're both contract documents. So it's common for a court to have to do something to interpret and reconcile an inconsistency or a contradiction. The first step is pretty obvious. The court looks at the contract, looks at all of it, to figure out whether there is truly a contradiction or an inconsistency in the contract. Are there direct contradictions of words, or is there an interpretation that might allow the contract to be read as a whole so that something might be stated but meant for a specific location, and something inconsistent might be stated but meant for general locations, just not that one specific exception. That happens all the time when you have typical details and then you have specific details for specific situations that don't fit into the typical. There was a case of about 20 or 30 years ago where the specifications could be read to require a completely concrete floor, period, but the drawings showed a partial steel plate covering the floor because it was necessary for weight distribution purposes. So now we have two different portions of a construction contract. One that says the floor will be concrete, and the other that shows a concrete floor but with a steel plate. Is that a contradiction? Well, you could think so, but the court reasoned that it wasn't a contradiction because the specifications didn't say there will be no steel plate. The specifications were just silent on whether a steel plate would go over the top of the concrete floor. And therefore, the court held they didn't truly contradict the drawings, which clearly showed the steel plate. Rules like that or analyses like that are used all the time to figure out whether there's really an inconsistency in the construction contract. There are rules that a court will use to try to resolve inconsistencies if they decide there is one. If they decide there is no inconsistency, you don't have to resort to the rules. The court just interprets both provisions in the contract to mean what they say. But there often are rules given right in the contract for resolving inconsistencies. That's especially true in construction documents. Have you seen, do you know what front-end documents are in specifications? Ever hear that term? Well, the front end is the portion of the specifications that's really more of a business terms and conditions than it is technical specifications for construction. Do you know what Master Spec is? Master Spec is an organization that puts out standardized specifications divided into divisions. Each division is a particular area of construction, except that Division 1 is called the front-end documents, and those have business or related terms. Frequently, you'll see a business term in the front-end of the specifications that says something like, in case of an inconsistency between the drawings and specifications, the specifications shall control over the drawings. There may also be a provision that says, in case of an inconsistency or ambiguity in the description of the contractor's work, the contractor is to assume that the more expensive or greater amount of work shall apply. So if something calls for a particular kind of floor covering in the drawings and a different kind of floor covering in a different drawing, the contractor is supposed to figure on the more expensive one. A third possibility is that the contract itself may say the contractor has read and carefully reviewed all of the drawings and specifications and has raised with the architect any questions about potential ambiguities, inconsistencies, etc. To the extent that the contractor has not raised an issue as an ambiguity, then the contractor is conceding that it isn't an ambiguity and will rely on the interpretation of the architect to resolve any such questions. That's putting the duty on a particular party as opposed to the other to have the obligation to raise any inconsistencies or ambiguities and have them resolved. Now, although these rules are stated in the contracts, in practice, courts often don't enforce them, especially in situations where they believe it to be unfair. It's particularly unfair in a bidding process where contractors are asked to assume that the more expensive alternative will apply. Because contractors are bidding against each other, they're never going to assume that there's a more expensive alternative because they're trying to keep their numbers as low as possible. Courts acknowledge that it's generally not workable to require contractors to bid a more expensive alternative in a competitive bidding situation. Also, courts have been known to turn this duty of inquiring on its head and to say that even though the contract says that the contractor has a duty to inquire, the document was really prepared by the owner through its architect. So the owner really has the obligation to draft it in a way not to have ambiguities. We'll talk about that next. Those are judicial rules of contract construction. When the contract itself doesn't contain a rule on how to interpret it, the courts will invent their own rules that they apply to contracts generally, not just construction contracts, but any contract in any industry or field. One of the standard rules that judges use is to follow the specific rather than the general provision. If there are a bunch of window bays, and the drawing shows a typical detail for how it's to be framed out, except that there is a specific detail for one window bay that happens to be in a corner, and the contractor follows the typical detail for all the windows, including the corner window, the court's likely to have a problem with that, because the court is going to see that there is a specific detail for a specific window and will generally apply its own rule of contract construction that says a specific instruction supersedes general instructions for the area in which that specific instruction is intended. And that's what you want, isn't it? As architects, you'll do typical details, but then you'll notice places where those don't work and include specific exceptions. If a contractor could rely on a typical detail to ignore your specific exceptions, you wouldn't have any way to make them make the specific exceptions. What could you possibly do? So this judicial rule makes a lot of sense. A second judicial rule, which was one I alluded to a little bit ago, is interpreting the contract against one of the party's interests. And that's against the party who prepared it, who drafted it. Courts applying a judicial rule will decide that someone who prepares a contract has a lot more opportunity to wordsmith it than somebody who's just reading it with the expectation of negotiating and signing it. Someone who actually carefully places the words in the contract has a greater onus of making sure that they don't contradict themselves or create ambiguities. So in the situation I was telling you about before, where the contract tries to put the obligation on the contractor to ask about ambiguities, courts will sometimes hold that that's unreasonable if the ambiguity isn't obvious. If the ambiguity is based on an architect's interpretation or something like that, that the contractor might not have been able to infer just from eyeballing the contract. In which case, though, the court may apply its judicial rule that says we construe the contract against the owner because the owner drafted it. Or it might be the reverse. An architectural contract, something you have to be careful about. odds are your clients, unless they're major institutions, won't have their own architecture contract forms to use. With your clients, most of the time, it's going to be your contract form, because you do architecture repetitively. Your clients probably do it rarely, or have construction projects rarely. So you're going to be doing the initial draft, most of the time, of the architect's contract. And you need to be aware that it will be construed against you if there's an unclarity in it. That means you need to give particular care to the wording in your proposals or any other document that might be construed as a contract, ultimately. Because if you leave wiggle room, the court probably will allow your client to take advantage of it in the event of a dispute about contract interpretation. One of the common and favored judicial rules of contract construction is to construe the contract as a whole and to try to effectuate its overall purpose. That makes sense because there's no point in looking at a contract clause in a vacuum. That's not how the parties intended it. The purpose of that part of the contract is to illustrate the deal. So it may make perfect sense as part of the overall illustration of the deal that the clause is supposed to be interpreted one way rather than another. No examples are coming to my mind off the top of my head. But suppose it's a construction contract for a high-rise building. The drawings are being done on a fast-track kind of basis, and you turn out a drawing for a typical floor, or typical floor interior, or something like that. The court would, if there's a dispute about the extent to which that's supposed to apply, the court would probably look at the project as a whole and say, this is being done fast-track, construction starting before design has even begun. We'll talk about that in the second half of the semester. And that means that when something, when a design is turned out for a particular floor, that even though you don't have the designs for all the other floors, they're probably going to be the same or similar to what you got on the first floor. So a court would look at the overall structure of the deal to try to figure out what makes the most sense in interpreting any of the documents in a contract. Modification of contracts. This is a fairly simple concept. The rule is, if you can make the contract, you can change the contract. If you think about it, any contract signed by two people can have a second document signed by the same two people that changes the first document. A contract number two can always change contract number one. So, what is a change order in a construction contract? It's a subsequent agreement signed by the owner and the contractor that modifies the work and modifies the price of the contract. So the same parties who entered into the contract can always agree to change it. Now, different parties can't. If the owner and contractor have a contract, you as the architect can't do anything to change that. It's got to be the owner and contractor together agreeing to change it. Obviously, they're the people who made the deal in the first place. There are a lot of contracts that say that they can't be modified. Well, that's fine and dandy, but those words aren't worth the paper that they're written on. Even a contract that says that it can't be modified can be modified by the people who signed it simply by signing something later that says, we'll take out the part of the contract that says it can't be modified, and we'll modify it as follows. So two people to a contract can never be stopped from modifying that contract as long as they both agree, even if the contract explicitly says so. Sometimes the contract says, and this is typical for construction and design contracts, this contract can only be modified by a written document signed by both parties to the original contract. Well, that's true that it can be modified by the same party signing a subsequent document. But what if the same two parties were to get together and just talk and they said, you know, I think that I'd like you to do this extra piece of work, and I'm willing to pay you $5,000 to do it. And the contractor turns around and says, deal. They shake on it. Well, if that were just a contract all by itself, it would be binding and enforceable. It's an oral contract, of course, but it's got all the requisites for enforceability. Both sides have given consideration. There's an offer and an acceptance. There's no reason that's not a contract. So if you can do a contract orally, why can't you modify a written contract orally? Well, you could. You could have the same two people saying, I don't have my change order forms here, but I'm willing to give you a change order for $5,000 if you'll build this in addition to your prescribed scope of work. And the contractor says, deal. And they shake. That modifies the construction contract, even if the construction contract says that it can't, says that the deal, that the modification has to be in writing. So no modification or limited modification clauses are generally worthless. Why do you want a subsequent modification to be in writing? Well, for the same reason you really want the contract to be in writing, because you can keep a record of it and you know exactly what it says. You can describe whatever work is being added carefully, and there won't be any dispute about what the scope of the newly added work is. You want the modification to be in writing because written contracts are easier to interpret because you've got the clauses there in black and white. Now, there is a legal doctrine called reformation. It's really instituting a lawsuit to change the terms of your contract. It's very rare. It is possible to do, but only in very limited circumstances. You can go to court and get the court to physically change your, legally change the terms of your contract only when the terms of the contract don't accurately reflect what the real deal was, like a drafting mistake. If you can prove that you made a drafting mistake, you left out a decimal point, or you added a zero that you were never intended to add, and you can prove that the real deal is with one less zero, then you might have a chance to go to court and change the contract to be what it's to be what the real deal was. Now you can't. The problem is that, you know, suppose your fee was $10,000, but you left off a zero, so it says $1,000. Now your client may want to enforce the contract as written, and given the parole evidence rule that says you don't even look for parole evidence if the wording of the contract is clear, you're dead in the water. Your contract says $1,000. Unfortunately, both you and your client are in the U.S., so there's no Canadian dollar thing to throw in. How can you get around a contract where you put your fee down wrong? Well, you can't get the court to interpret it in your favor. That's not possible to do. It's clearly in your client's favor. All you can ask a court to do is to reform it. And to reform it, you have to have a good reason. These are similar to the defenses to breach of contract that we're going to be talking about next. You might be able to prove that there was a mutual mistake of fact, that neither you nor your client was aware that the figure said 1,000 instead of 10,000, and that both of you meant it to be 10,000. It's just a scrivener's error, as it's called. Now that works if your client says, yeah, I thought it was supposed to be 10,000 too. Then you're fine. Then both of you made the mistake and the court will reform it. But if the client says, no, I thought I had bargained you down to a great fee of $1,000. That's always what I expected it to be. Then you're screwed because you don't have a mutual mistake of fact anymore. You have a unilateral mistake of fact, where only one person made the mistake, you, and your client is saying, no mistake on my part, I always wanted it to say 1,000.
You said the reform contract would be the lawsuit. Now, if there's a mutual mistake of fact, what's the point of the lawsuit?
The point of the lawsuit is to change the contract so that it reflects your real deal.
Well, I'm sorry, but there's no dispute between the contract.
Well,
wouldn't it be more?
I mean, that's why, you're right, that's why mutual mistake of fact rarely is pled in court, because if there is a mutual mistake of fact and the owner is mensch enough to own up to it and simply say, yeah, you're right, it was always supposed to be 10,000, just draw in the other zero and that's how I'll pretend it's written, then you're fine. It's only when the owner says, well, I'm not sure, and it's usually not a personal owner. What it may be is, say, a bank or a title company or somebody like that who's bound to the paperwork. It may be a different person processing the contract than the person who entered into it and, you know, red tape. They won't pay more than $1,000 because that's all it says, even if the both of you agree. You may need to take the contract to court to get it reformed so that the person at the title company is willing to disburse the right amount. It does come up in situations like that. But suppose it's just a unilateral mistake. It means only one person made the mistake. The client always, instead is taking advantage of you. You wrote $1,000 and the client saw it and he said, aha, that's a mistake, but it's in my favor. So why should I say anything about it? Maybe I can get away saving $9,000 of fee. Well, in a situation like that, the court will also reform the contract because you're not allowed to take advantage of the other party unfairly. And here the client would have been taking advantage of your typo by pretending that it was only a $1,000 fee. If you can prove that he knew better all along and just was keeping the information from you, then you'll also succeed in reforming the contract. Or it could be fraud. There are times when somebody erases something from the contract and tries to pretend it was never there, really tries to cheat. Think of fraud as cheating, and the court will never countenance that. So if you can prove your client cheated to end up with the result of the wrong term in the contract, then you'll almost always get reformation. Now let's move on to breach of the contract. We're not interpreting it any longer. Now we have a situation where one party or the other breached the contract. That means violated one or more of its terms. We'll even assume that you've been able to prove that the other side breached the contract. What happens next? Well, the court applies a philosophy in general when a contract is breached. And the general philosophy is to try to restore equity. In other words, to put the innocent party back in the situation they would have been in if the breach hadn't occurred. That's the usual approach. Now remember that contract law is civil law, not criminal law. Criminal law is involved with punishments for behavior. Civil law does not deal with punishment. Civil law deals with expectations and commerce. So it would be wrong to say that one of the purposes of remedies for breach of contracts would be to punish the contract breacher. It's not evil or bad to breach a contract. It's just a commercial fact. And that's how the law views it. It's not as if you were a bad actor if you breach a contract. You may have no choice. You may have gone bankrupt. You may find it physically impossible to perform. There may be a lot of ways that you breach the contract that's not even your fault. So there's no punishment going on. What a court will do almost all the time is award money. Money is the typical damage for breach of contract. We'll go into a few exceptions later. But almost exclusively, you get money damages when you breach the contract. 90%+ of the time, so the overwhelming majority of the time, the money damages are called expectation damages. Expectation damages. That's an important concept. That means that the innocent party is put in the same financial position they would have been in if there never had been a breach of the contract and the thing had been fully performed. Sometimes this is just so obvious you can't believe it. You have a $50,000 architectural fee. Your client pays you the first $30,000, but then stiffs you on the last $20,000 after you finish the drawings. You go to court for breach of the contract, and the breach was the payment term, because the owner didn't pay you. And what's your measure of damages? Well, it's trivial. It's so easy. The court says, if he had properly performed the contract, you get damages, you would have been paid $50,000. Because he breached, you were only paid $30,000. So he owes you, obviously, the other $20,000 of the contract. So the court will award you $20,000. Although it may be more complicated than that. Let's add interest. Because the $20,000 was supposed to be paid to you 3 years ago. Because it took that long for you to get to trial. And interest rates, you had to borrow $20,000 from your bank in order to cover the shortfall in your cash flow. So in addition to owing you the $20,000, the court will probably order the owner to pay you the interest that you got stuck with borrowing to cover the shortfall. Because that would put you in the same situation you would have been in had there never been a shortfall in the first place. In the payment situation, it's easy to calculate expectation damages. It's a little bit harder in a service situation. Let's deal with a construction contract now. The owner hires contractor number one to build this $1 million project. The contractor starts the work, but then after being paid $400,000, goes bankrupt, leaves the site. Let's not say bankrupt. Let's just say he stops doing the work and leaves the site. Maybe he got a more lucrative offer for another project and had to move his men there. So the owner is forced to hire contractor number two. Contractor number two comes to the site and says, hey, this is a mess. I'm not sure of exactly what scope of work has been done and hasn't, what's been pulled through the conduits and what hasn't. I'm going to charge $800,000 to finish this job, even though, Mr. Owner, you've already paid $400,000. And the owner can't get a cheaper bid. So the owner stuck paying contractor number two $800,000 to finally finish the project. Well, what's the owner entitled to if he sues contractor number one for breach of contract? It's a subtraction problem. The owner ended up paying $1.2 million. $800 to contractor two, $400 to contractor number one. He should only have paid $1 million because that's what the contract with contractor one said, right? So contractor one owes him the $200,000 difference, because that would make the owner whole. It's not that complicated. It works with you and a subconsultant as well. I mean, suppose you hire a structural engineering subconsultant and pay him, say, it's a $30,000 subconsulting agreement because it's a big project, lots of structure. You hire the guy and you've paid him $20,000 to do the work. And he's done some of the drawings, but not all of them. And then he can't continue for whatever reason. Maybe his license gets revoked, something funny like that. But you need that work finished. So you take what's in progress to structural engineer number two, but he hasn't done all the calculations himself, and he's not allowed to rely on the first engineer's calculations without checking them. So he has to duplicate a bunch of the work that's already been done. So he charges you $20,000 to take it from where it is and finish. Now you've paid $40,000 for a subconsulting agreement that was only $30,000. You have the right to sue the subconsultant to get $10,000 back. That's your overpayment. It will make you whole if you get that amount of money back. The second one didn't breach the contract. The first one did. So you're suing the first one for the consequences of his breach of contract, which is, and the real consequence when you get to the bottom line, is that it cost you $10,000 more to have the structural work done than it should have. So it's the $10,000 that you get awarded to make you whole. 90%+ of this of damages for breach of contract our expectation damages. Almost all the time, the court uses that formula. But there are some times when it doesn't really work. Reliance damages can be used instead. Think of reliance measure of damages as being getting your money back. That's what it really means. And that happens sometimes when it's impossible to figure out what the expectation damages are. Say that you have a contract to design a project for a fee of $50,000. It's a lump sum fee, and somewhere in the middle of the project, the owner cancels the project. Can't afford it anymore, for whatever reason he terminates you. Now, how do you know how much it would have, what position you would have been in had the contract not been canceled, terminated, breached? You don't know. You don't know how much time and effort you would have had to put in. You don't know if you would have earned a big profit because you would have been very efficient, or whether you underestimated the job and you'd have been suffering a net loss at the end. There's no way to predict what the future of that project would have been. So instead, you ask for your reliance damages back, essentially getting back in your pocket what you've already invested in the project. In this case, it would be the value of your hours. So you'd say, I had a standard hourly billing rate of $125 an hour. I put 70 hours into this project. There's no way to calculate whether what my expectation damages would be, so simply give me the value of my time back, 70 hours at $125 an hour. Multiply that, and that's your reliance damages. If expectation damages are easy to figure out, that's what the court will use. The court will generally only use reliance measures of damages when the expectation damages are unclear or difficult to calculate. Restitution is a different concept entirely. Reliance damages are measured by the innocent party getting back whatever they invested into the project. Restitution damages are measured by the contract breacher. Classic example is the sale of real estate where something valuable is discovered on it. Party A enters into a contract with Party B to buy Party B's land. It's a valid contract. The closing is going to be on next week. And then all of a sudden, Party B discovers oil underground on his land. So Party B breaches the contract and refuses to transfer the real estate to Party A. Party A sues, but how do you figure out what the expectation damages would be in a situation like that? It's not clear. You don't know what the values of land are, and reliance damages don't make any sense. So the restitution damages would be receiving the windfall that the contract breacher got. Suppose that the oil underground is valued at $10 million. Just to use a round number. Well, that is the windfall that the contract breacher got. So you should be entitled to be paid $10 million less the purchase price of the land, because you would have always had to give up the purchase price, and the land, presumably with the oil, is now worth $10 million. As you can see, this is a really rare situation. It doesn't happen very often. And as a practical matter, I don't think you need to know a whole lot about that for the construction industry. Sure. Good question. The remedy for breach of contract is independent of what forum the dispute is resolved in. So whether you're in court or in arbitration or in some negotiation process, these are the rules that would be applied. They would apply regardless of who's making the decision. This is simply the law, and any of these different forums would apply the law. So these are money damages for breach of contract. In rare situations, however, you can get damages that aren't money. You can get a damage that's called an equitable remedy. An equitable remedy is It's a strange word, because equitable you think of as meaning fair, right? Well, that's not really what the law means by it. If you go back to medieval England, their court system split into two different components. This is a history lesson you're not responsible for, but in case you're curious, they had the law division, which was generally for breach of contract cases, accident cases, things where money was awardable. And then they had what's called the chancery division, which we still have here in Cook County. We have a law division and a chancery division. The chancery division is the one that's considered an equitable court, and it is allowed to issue orders and do things that an ordinary law court cannot. So there are some special remedies that may exist for breach of a contract. One, for example, is an injunction. You ever hear the word injunction? An injunction is just a court order that forbids someone from doing something or possibly requires them to do something. You can get, that may come up in the construction industry. For example, confidential information. Typically what happens when you have a client who's in some reasonably sensitive business, even retailing, they will have a whole bunch of confidential information that you need to know in order to design their space. But they don't want you giving it out to their competitors. So they make you sign a confidentiality agreement before you start to get any of this information. And that confidentiality agreement says that a court can grant an injunction to stop you from disseminating the information. So if they were to find out that you placed a phone call to their competitor and set up a meeting for next week where it's your intent to share this information with them, they're paying you to do it, to be a stool pigeon or something, they could run into court and get an immediate injunction, because these equitable courts, these chancery courts, can hear you on a day's notice. It's a totally different type of court system. And they can get a court order that says, you are forbidden from meeting with these people, at least for a period of X time, until we can go, everybody can come into court and sort out what's going on. Because your defense might be perfectly innocent. Your defense might be, I'm not meeting with them to give them any confidential information. I'm meeting with them because I specialize in retail interiors, and they're somebody else who has retail interiors, and I'm trying to get work from them too. The fact that they're a competitor of yours is incidental. I don't forbid myself from working with your competitors. I won't share your confidential information. I'm just trying to pitch them. Well, that may be a perfectly fine defense, but if your client can prove that you were about to give out confidential information, then they can go to court and get an injunction to stop you. Now, I should have put injunction up here. I didn't. But it is one of these equitable remedies. Another equitable remedy is called specific performance. Specific performance applies when, usually when you're buying or doing something that's unique. Suppose there were a particular Picasso painting that you were purchasing. And it's unique. I mean, it's a well-known painting. It's appraised. Everybody in the art world knows what it is. And you enter into a contract to buy it for $25,000. May you be so lucky. And the art dealer ends up refusing to sell it to you. Maybe he got an offer from somebody else that's more. Now, you could certainly just seek to get your money back if you wanted to. It doesn't help to get expectation damages, because maybe the painting's appraised at $25,000. What would your expectation damages be if you were unable to buy a $25,000 painting for $25,000? It'd be zero. It's not like you were making a profit on the transaction. You were paying fair market value. So you're basically in the same position you were before. But that's not why you wanted the painting. You wanted the painting because you love it. You're a Picasso fan, you wanted it hanging in your living room. Well, it's a unique item. You can't substitute some other painting and say, it's a work of art, so it's the same thing. When you have a unique item, the court will enforce the contract as it was written. It will make the other side specifically perform the contract. So in this case, it would make the art dealer transfer the painting to you once you transferred $25,000 to the art dealer. Now, this isn't just true of paintings. It's true of real estate, too. It's just true as a matter of law that every piece of real estate is considered to be unique. So when I gave you that transaction with the oil underground before, where a guy bought a piece of land but it turned out to have oil underneath, one of the remedies that that person could have insisted on was specific performance, so that the party who owned the land would be forced to sign the deed over to the first party once the first party paid the money to the second party. The court would enforce that transaction exactly as written because each piece of land is considered to be unique. This can apply to architecture, although it rarely does. I think that the theory makes sense. Suppose somebody hires a well-known architect to design a particular house or whatever it is. There's a contract, but then the architect, before even beginning work, loses interest in the project, returns the retainer or whatever he took for the project, and says, go hire somebody else. Could the client force that architect to do the work because that architect is like an artist whose work is unique and it can't be can't be traded for a generic architect? Well, you can make an argument both yes and no. There are contradictory considerations here. One consideration is that the work is unique. So yes, you would think you might be able to get specific performance. But there's a stronger consideration that trumps that. The stronger consideration is that courts have a policy of never ordering two people to work together who can't stand to work together. They won't force a person to actually provide services, you know, working for somebody else if they can't or don't want to. So in this case, you wouldn't be able to, the owner would not be able to enforce the architect to actually do the job. They'd be able to, if they had to go to some other architect who charged more, and that was a reasonable substitute, the owner would get the price difference as money damages. But you can't compel an individual to do something that that individual is refusing to do. And the reason is that the court can't be an arbiter of something done grudgingly. Imagine if you were that unique architect and you were forced to work for a client you didn't want to work for. Can you imagine how terrible your work would be? Because you wouldn't care about it, or you'd be interested in screwing the client over after they took you to court. So it just doesn't work to force A to work for B, and courts will never do that. If the LLC is just kind of a trapping for an individual, because, you know, all the top architects in the city work through entities like that, then the court wouldn't enforce the two to work together. But if it were kind of an arm's length commercial transaction between two companies, then the individual issues wouldn't rise to the forefront and the court might enforce it. It depends on the circumstances. Another equitable remedy could be rescission of the contract. Rescission of the contract is like canceling the contract. In a lot of ways, it's like reformation of contracts that we talked about earlier. And when you reform a contract, the contract stays in place and you just change its terms to reflect what the real agreement was. In a rescission action, you're trying to cancel the contract. And you'd be canceling it for the same kinds of reasons. That there was a mutual mistake of fact, for example. Maybe both of you thought that the property was zoned commercial, but in fact it's zoned residential and you can't get a zoning change or variance. In that case, there may be a mutual mistake of fact that makes the contract impossible and therefore rescindable. Fraud can cause a contract to be rescinded as well. But it's pretty rare. Usually, if there's fraud or something like that that's going on, you have a breach of good faith terms in the contract. And a contract breacher doesn't have the right to enforce the contract after the breach. So rescission is a pretty rare equitable remedy. There are other types of important damages you need to know about in the construction industry, probably things you've heard about. One type of damage is called consequential damages. There's a term on this in every AIA contract. Now, a consequential damage, by the way, these are all assuming we're dealing with an expectation type of damage, the usual type of money damages. But a consequential damage is one that's kind of causally remote. It's not directly caused by the breach of contract. It's caused by a variety of factors that make it come into play. Let me give you an example. You have a construction contract to build a factory that's going to manufacture widgets. If there are construction defects so that the factory doesn't operate properly, then you clearly have a breach of contract. The contractor breached his construction contract by building wrong. And the direct damages to the owner will likely be the cost of fixing the problem. So if it costs the owner an extra $100,000 to fix the construction defects to get the factory up and working, then the owner's paid $100,000 more than he should have had to pay for a working factory. And that means that his expectation damages are $100,000. Those are direct damages because they're directly the result of the breach, the defective construction. But now, let's suppose that because of the repairs, the factory was out of commission for a while, and therefore, it didn't produce as many widgets as it otherwise would have. So the owner lost the opportunity to sell widgets. And if he can prove that he would have made a profit of $1 per widget, does he have the right to collect that lost profit from the delay in opening the factory that is the result of the defective construction? Or let's take it one step further. Let's say that this was a pharmaceuticals rather than widgets. And let's say that because of the construction defect, this particular drug was late hitting the market. And therefore, it lost out on market share to another drug that came out just a little bit before. You know all the erectile dysfunction drugs? What is it? Viagra, Cialis, and can't remember what the last one was. But Viagra dominates that market. It came out first, and it's almost become generic. So when people talk about that kind of drug, they talk about taking Viagra. Remember when photocopier machines were fairly new, what everybody called them? Are you old enough for that? Right. They were called Xerox machines, because Xerox came out with the first ones. And by coming out first ahead of everybody else, Xerox dominated the market. Everybody went to Xerox to buy a photocopier, even though Canon and Sharp made photocopiers too. Xerox just came up first. And as a result, they sold way more because they came out first. Well, what about this factory? Because it was shut down to correct the construction defects, it came to market second instead of first. It would have been first if the defect hadn't occurred. So is that loss of market share and loss of all the profits that go with it one of the damages that's reimbursable because of the breach of contract? Well, if you followed just expectation damage theory, the answer would be yes. Because if there had not been a breach, the factory would never have shut down, all the extra widgets would have been made, and they would have captured even more market share and therefore more profits to the owner. So that's what the owner should get. The cost of the repairs, the profits on the widgets that he didn't get a chance to make because the factory was down, and the lost profits from losing market share from being late to market. That would make him whole. But some of these things are pretty remote consequences of the original deal. The rule for consequential damages up here on the board is that they are recoverable, but only if they were within the contemplation of the parties, if they were reasonably foreseeable when the contract was signed. So in this case, with the factory and the widgets, clearly when the contract was signed, the contractor knew that if he built it defectively and it was going to need repair that the owner paid for, that was something that was going to come out of his pocket. The possibility of the construction defect is always in the party's minds when they're signing a construction contract. And in fact, delay in opening was probably, but not definitely, on their minds. It might, in the contract, say, Our goal for opening is January 1, 2012, in which case delay would clearly have been within the reasonably foreseeable from this kind of, when the contract was formed. But it's something to argue about. The court might take testimony as to whether the parties were really focusing on an opening date or not in the negotiating of the construction contract. It's not clear whether delay is a consequential damage. But I'll tell you, it's pretty unlikely that the contractor even understood what market share was. When the contractor signed the construction contract, he probably had no idea that there was a competitor just a couple months behind them who was ready to beat them to market if there was a delay in his job. So it's probably true that loss of market share concepts were not reasonably foreseeable or within the contemplation of the parties when the contract was signed. Therefore, those damages, even though they would be expectation damages, are considered consequential and not recoverable. This is important because consequential damages arise all the time. They are important enough that when we see the AIA documents, you're going to see that there's an explicit clause in them that addresses consequential damages. It basically says that nobody is thinking of consequential damages when we sign this contract, so there won't be any claims for consequential damages. Now that, in an architecture contract, that's great. It works in your favor, because what consequential damages do you have? I mean, if a client breaches your architecture contract, what is the breach almost all the time? It's non-payment, right? Or underpayment. And there aren't any remote consequences from that. The consequence is that you have a shortfall and you're entitled to be paid. But it's not like you lose some other job somewhere because you weren't paid for this one, at least 99% of the time. But owners have real consequential damages. If you're dealing with, you're designing a shopping mall, you know, any mistakes or delays by you in producing your drawings could delay the tenant rent out and delay the rental payments that they would earn and could have all kinds of remote consequences. So owners typically have a lot of potential consequential damages, and architects typically have none. And contractors don't have a whole lot either. Some, but we'll talk about those later. So consequential damages are an important concept for architecture and construction, and whether they're awardable depend on whether the parties were contemplating or reasonably foreseeing them at the point in time where the contract was signed. Liquidated damages. You ever heard that term before? LDs, if you've ever been on a construction site? Well, the typical liquidated damages are per day delay payments. A typical construction contract may say something like, for every day that the contractor finishes late, he'll pay the owner $100. You might think of them as some kind of penalty clause, although we're going to see that that's not really the case at all. Liquidated damages is a concept that simply means that we're going to stipulate what the damages for an event actually are, because they're hard to prove otherwise. And that's true. So in order to be recoverable, liquidated damages, to have a liquidated damages clause is part of a contract that says something like the following. If this event were to occur as a result of a breach of contract, it would be really hard to calculate what the real consequences are. So the parties agree that instead of trading calculations, we'll just put a number on them right here in the contract and stipulate that number to be true. So if the contractor is late in delivering the project, instead of the owner calculating up what his extra insurance costs are, what his extra interest payments are on the construction loan, and all of that kind of stuff, we'll just stipulate that the damages are $100 a day for each day late. The general rule is that liquidated damages have to bear a reasonable relationship, somewhat reasonable, to what the actual number would be, and they have to be difficult to calculate at the point in time when the contract was signed. So when you're signing the contract, if you think of this potential event and you know that it's difficult to prove up what the consequences will be, you can liquidate that amount by stating it right in the contract. But they have to bear a reasonable relationship to what the real damages might be. Suppose it's a single family residence, and the contract says, we really want this house to be ready on time. So to incentivize the contractor, the parties agree that for every day that the contractor is late, he'll pay the owner $10,000. Well, obviously the owner is not being injured $10,000 a day. That's not the cost of renting a hotel room and paying extra interest on your construction loan. You know, the more likely it's $100 or $300 or $500, maybe even $1,000 a day, but not $10,000. That's ridiculous. The reason that a court will not allow that kind of clause is that philosophy I gave you at the beginning of this talk, that the purpose of contract law has nothing to do with punishment. It has to do with compensation. And putting an incentive clause or a penalty clause in a contract is a form of punishment. The court will not enforce it. So if you have a clause that calls for a penalty to be paid, it is void and not worth the paper it's written on. The word incentive is really just kind of a synonym for punishment. The incentive is avoid the penalty by finishing on time. So incentivizing the contractor doesn't work either. Let me give you two different clauses that are very similar, and you'll see that there are really some big differences between them. One's enforceable and one's not. If you were to say that the parties want to ensure that the contractor finishes on time so that they are stipulating to a penalty of $1,000 a day for late completion, that clause would be thrown out and not enforceable because it's clearly stated to be a penalty. But use the same number and change the language and you can get it enforced. If you were to say, it's clear that the owner would be damaged if the contractor finishes late, but it's very hard to calculate how much that damage would be. The parties agree that $1,000 per day is a reasonable estimate of what that damage would be, and therefore stipulate that the contractor will pay as liquidated damages to the owner the sum of $1,000 for every day that he's late. Now, the clause does the exact same thing as that penalty clause I gave you, but this is a truly liquidated damages clause, not a penalty. Its words don't intend to impose a penalty, just compensation, reimbursement. And therefore, it is enforceable. So the court will look at the amount, and if it's a ridiculously high amount, then it's automatically a penalty clause. But if it's not ridiculously high, the court will look at the language of the provision to see whether the parties intend it to be a penalty or real liquidated compensation, at least from the point of time in which the contract was signed. I'll give you a couple of real cases here that happened in one in Chicago, well, one isn't a case, but one is out in San Francisco, where they've gotten very creative with these liquidated damages clauses. You know that the Golden Gate Bridge is always being painted? You ever hear that story? By the time the painting contractor gets to one end, the other end is ready to start again. So they're basically painting it all the time. It's a permanent job. But in painting the Golden Gate Bridge, they're taking a lane of traffic away from Marin County causes traffic jams, up the wazoo. Ridiculous. So there are all kinds of restrictions on when the painter is allowed to barricade off a lane and when the barricades have to be lifted to allow traffic to go through. I think the barricades have to be up by 7 a.m., I'm not certain. But there's a liquidated damages clause in that painting contractor's contract that's hourly, not daily. It says for every hour after 7 a.m. that a barrier remains in place, that the city and its inhabitants are being damaged from the traffic backups to the tune of X dollars per hour, which will be imposed as liquidated damages. So liquidated damages aren't just per diem, per day. They could be per hour, per month, whatever you set forth in the contract. You can be creative with it. One of the famous cases came out of Chicago, where they were building the expressway system, you know, the Kennedy, Dan Ryan expressways. I think it was back in the mid-50s that this was built. And this case was decided in federal court here in Chicago in 1957. And it was actually the city of Chicago versus Bethlehem Steel. Bethlehem Steel had supplied the big steel columns that hold up the overpasses. And we're on a tight schedule for supplying this. Now, of course, that was very early in the job. You know, on the critical path, the columns come very early so that all the construction can take place above it. And at the time that they signed the contract to buy it and bring the steel to the site, everybody thought that delay might be critical, that if the steel was brought to the site late, then all the rest of the work would be pushed further back, and the expressways would open late, and traffic would be horribly snarled. So they drafted a liquidated damages clause that's between the city and Bethlehem Steel that was like what I told you about San Francisco. Not hourly, but daily. The city of Chicago legal department did well on this one. And it said that since the steel is on the critical path for construction, it seems likely that late delivery of the steel would cause a late opening of the expressways, which would damage the city to an incalculable extent, because how do you calculate the cost of traffic jams, and which the parties agreed to liquidate at X thousand dollars per day or whatever it was. So it was a standard liquidated damages clause drafted perfectly well and would normally be perfectly enforceable. And what happened? Sure enough, Bethlehem Steel was late with the columns. And construction started late as a consequence. But lo and behold, the contractors were able to pick up lost time. The expressways ended opening on time anyway. They were not late. And the city of Chicago withheld the liquidated damages amount from Bethlehem Steel because they were late with the steel, and that's what the liquidated damages clause said to do. It was hundreds of thousands of dollars of liquidated damages. Bethlehem Steel sued to get the money because they said there was no damage. The expressways opened on time, and the city of Chicago would receive a windfall if it kept this money because it's not compensating them for any loss. They didn't lose anything. We met, this expressways met the completion date. Well, the court disagreed with Bethlehem Steel and allowed the city of Chicago to keep the money. And that's because the rule of liquidated damages is based on the time at which the contract is signed and what seems likely. If when the contract is signed, it seemed likely that delays would delay the expressways, well, then the clause was enforceable. It was always valid, always enforceable. You don't have to wait to see if there are real damages in order to collect liquidated damages. That's the purpose of liquidated damages, to avoid having to prove what the real damages are. So the city of Chicago was allowed to keep the money even though it wasn't damaged by late expressway opening because it was reasonable to assume in the contract that they would be and the clause was otherwise enforceable. So liquidated damages come up all the time on construction projects. Now there's a huge misunderstanding that most construction contractors have. The misunderstanding is that if there are no LDs, liquidated damages, in the contract, then there are no delay damages, no damages for delay. Well, that's wrong. If the contract doesn't have liquidated damages, or if the liquidated damages clause was thrown out as being an illegal penalty clause, that doesn't mean the owner's out of luck. That just means that the owner can't liquidate his damages. Instead of having a specified sum to collect, the owner has to prove what his real losses were, what his expectation damages were. So it's not that a liquidated damages clause is the only form of delay damages. It's just a way to avoid having to prove what the real damages are because supposedly they're difficult to prove. How would the city of Chicago prove what the real loss was from a late opening of the expressway? What's the value of a traffic jam? When there is a liquidated damages clause in the contract, that is both the maximum and the minimum that the contractor has to pay. So if it turns out that because of a domino effect of other people being delayed, that the owner's real damages were bigger than the liquidated damages clause, too bad for the owner. He agreed to liquidate the damages at a lower level, and that's all he's able to collect. But similarly, if the city of Chicago's damages were zero or small, they're still entitled to keep their liquidated amount because the clause was enforceable. Sure. You can do that because there's no penalty or punishment involved in that. There's no reason you can't have a bonus clause for early completion. In fact, what typically happens is that there's a bonus clause for early completion of the same amount as the liquidated damages clause for late completion. That's a huge piece of proof that the liquidated damages number is reasonable because you're prepared to pay the same amount for early completion. Now, you don't have to do it that way. You can have a liquidated damages clause without a bonus clause, or the other way around. You can have a bonus clause without an LD clause. What happens in reality is that there's a trade-off. When I draft a construction contract for an owner, I try to pick a liquidated damages number that is big enough to incentivize the contractor to finish on time, but not so big that I can't accurately describe it as a liquidation of the owner's real damages. So you try to make it as high as you can get away with, because that can be a liquidated damages amount, but still have the side effect of incentivizing the contractor. And that's what you find in most construction contracts when you have a good lawyer drafting them. Punitive damages. If you've been punitive damages, you've probably all heard of that, heard of these. That's, you know, you've heard of claims in court where somebody's seeking punitive damages for some kind of behavior. Well, breach of contract is not a kind of behavior that allows punitive damages to be awarded. The court can't just tack on a penalty to punish the contract breacher because of the philosophy of contracts. Contracts are not a function of criminal law, and punishment has nothing to do with their enforcement. So punitive damages, which are defined as extra sanctions or compensation over and above your real losses, are simply not allowed for breach of contract cases. There are certain narrow exceptions that aren't worth for me to go into, but you can take it as a given that in basic, punitive damages are not awarded for breach of contract. Legal fees. Here we get a big inconsistency. If, as I'm telling you, the purpose of contract law is to make the innocent party whole, what happens when you have to go to sue to collect the last $20,000 of your fee? And you have to pay a lawyer $10,000 or $15,000 or even more to try the case and collect the money. Well, you're not made whole then when you get your $20,000 fee because you're out of pocket almost that much to use the court system. So logically, you would think that legal fees should be awardable to make the innocent party whole. In England, they are, but not in America. I can't completely tell you why. The courts say the philosophy is that they don't want to discourage impoverished people or people of modest means from using the court system, and if they could be penalized by having to reimburse the other side's legal fees if they lose, then it's unfair to them because they can't afford that. I don't know how accurate that really is. It seems to work okay in England. And you would think that expectation damages, the philosophy of it, would allow legal fees to be awarded. So in general, they are not. The only times they can be awarded are if a statute or if the contract says so. There are a lot of construction or even design contracts that say that if there's a dispute, the prevailing party will be entitled to collect their legal fees from the other party. That means if you are out $20,000 and have to sue your client, and you have to spend $15,000 to try the case, at the end of the day, when you're right, you collect $35,000. Your legal fees plus the $20,000 that you're owed, and you're made whole. But that's only if the right to have legal fees is set for, reimbursed is set forth in the contract. Without a contract right to it, you're out of luck. Unless you have a situation involving a statute. There are some laws on the books that say inherently the the prevailing party or the enforcing party has the right to get all of its legal fees back. There are some environmental statutes that say that. But most of the time, the statutes applicable to the construction industry do not. Now, there are mixed feelings about putting a clause like that in an architecture contract. If you anticipate that the likely dispute from your contract is going to be collecting your fees, then it makes sense to put that clause in the contract so you can be made whole when you win the case. But what happens if the claim is the other way around? What happens if it's a claim by an owner against you for a design mistake? Do you want to be on the hook for not only the cost of the repairs, but also the cost of the lawyer's fees? They probably aren't insurable, so that they would come out of your pocket instead of out of your your professional liability insurance policy. One of the solutions to that is not to have a parallel clause. The way I describe the legal fees clause is that the prevailing party, the party who wins in court, gets his or her legal fees paid by the other side. But you don't have to be that even-handed. Your contract could say that in any claim to collect fees, the architect shall be reimbursed all legal costs by the client. It doesn't have to provide the reverse, and it's still enforceable. So I tend to put those kinds of clauses in my architect client's contracts. I don't. Sometimes there's people put the word reasonable attorney's fees in there so that the lawyer can't go crazy and expect full compensation for it. But it's pretty hard to determine what's reasonable. There's no legal reason why you couldn't put a cap or some kind of limit on it. But when I'm drafting a contract for my architect clients, I don't want to do that because I don't know what the legal fees will be if they have to go and sue. By that time, rates may have gone up or it might be a complicated case, and the legal fees could be really high. So from the architect's standpoint, you generally don't want a cap on those fees if they apply to your collecting of your fees. The way that the clauses are drafted, the legal fees clause usually includes all costs relating to the collection of the fee, which not only includes paying the lawyer, but paying the court costs, paying court reporters, things like that.
Is there any conflict of interest if you're a lawyer and you're drafting the contract and you're also a lawyer that represents the person who is using that contract to extract legal fees?
If I drafted the legal fee collection clause for my architect client, then the architect hires me to enforce the contract? No. The only conflict of interest comes about when I would be representing both sides to a transaction, which has occurred. In fact, I just got conflicted out of a case recently for a major developer brought against a major architect, both of whom happen to be clients of mine for occasional work, and I obviously can't take one client's side against the other. But that's the only time that a lawyer would be conflicted out. Mitigation of damages. It means just what it says. If you're the innocent party and somebody else breaches the contract, you can't just stand idly by while the consequences to you continue to accumulate. You can't adopt the mindset that says, well, he's going to have to make me whole, so I don't care how much it is, let the damages come. Not true. The court imposes a duty even on the innocent party in a breach of contract claim. The innocent party has to act reasonably to try to minimize the loss, which means that if a contractor walks off the site, I can't just leave the site open and unattended and not taking any care of it so that things may get stolen, people could get hurt on it. I have to take reasonable steps to maybe fence the site, or maybe to hire a new contractor to take over. I don't have to guess the future perfectly if I'm the innocent party, but I have to do what is reasonable to minimize the consequences, because the courts don't allow an innocent party to take advantage even of a contract breacher. So Let's say that the factory, we have the factory that broke down because of a construction defect. And the part that I have to replace is going to take 6 months to come on order. Well, I can't just sit around and let 6 months of factory downtime accumulate if there's an alternative reasonable option, such as having a somebody come out and fabricate a piece on the site. Even if it costs a lot to do that, it's way less expensive in the long run than keeping my factory down for 6 months. So I should take the action that costs me the least out of pocket so I have the least amount of damages to seek from the contract breacher. You only have to do what's reasonable as an innocent party. Sometimes someone will look back with 20/20 hindsight and say, if they had done this, they would have avoided even more damages. And the reply to that might be, well, that turned out to be true, but there's no way I could have known that at the time. And the court will buy that excuse. The innocent party isn't expected to foresee the future or to act perfectly. They just have to act reasonably to minimize the consequences.
So what if the action seems reasonable actually turns out to be disastrous?
If it was reasonable at the time and just got unlucky, you're off the hook, because you only have to act reasonably and you're not responsible for foreseeing the future or for unlucky consequences. So let me repeat for everybody here. We agreed that we're making up the class on the B101 contract next Monday, which is the 14th of February. A lot of you weren't seated yet when we agreed on this. So there's going to be class here in this room at 10 o'clock a.m. on Monday the 14th. Bring your B101 contracts to it, because we're going to be talking about it. That's where we're going to make up this week we've fallen behind. If you have a conflict and cannot be here on Monday, although I think most of you are here for studio on Monday anyway, I will be posting the lecture on the website, and there won't be any video other than the contract itself. I'm going to be going through its important clauses, and I'll identify audibly which clause we're talking about, so you can have the contract open in front of you and listen to it and get all the substance you would have had you been sitting here. But please try to come, because it's just a lot easier when you can see it on the board and ask me a question if something I've said seems to be unclear to you. So I'll let you out a little bit early today, and I will see you next Monday, also next Wednesday, by the way, but Monday and Wednesday next week at 10 o'clock right here. Thanks.